Made by geeks, not by people who are supposed to know that stuff.
Yeah.
So welcome to this session. It's really great to have you all here, and it's we're living in interesting times. We see new attacks every day, and web attacks are getting increasingly popular. I think the last 2-3 years I've been involved with maybe 15, 20 very, very devastating incidents, all related to an initial breach through a web server. So the topic today is going to be web hacking. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of this session, the reason you're here, hopefully, unless you just got in the wrong room, is to get some awareness. We want to share our knowledge, our experience from the field, and what we see every day doing work as penetration testers, incident responders, reverse engineers, and all the stuff we do. So if you haven't met us before, my name is Marcus Murray. I am the security team manager of a small elite team working all over the world doing this kind of work. Hassan is one of the strongest knives in my toolbox. So I bring him along all the time, and we're this close.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's he's the solid guy and I'm the crazy dude, and we're so much different, we really complete each other.
Yeah,
so
sometimes you need to build a balance. And
he's the one who stops me from doing too crazy things, and I'm the one who makes you have some real fun in your life.
That's true.
So anyhow, this is for you guys who haven't met us before. This is going to be a complete live session. We're not going to use any PowerPoints and slides, nothing like that. It's going to be completely hands-on. So I hope you appreciate that. The backside of that is you're not going to get any nice notes from the session unless you know the URL to the share where you can get all the tools and stuff that we're going to post later this week. So we'll handle that later, but I just want to tell you that you're going to get access to everything you need in order to be able to recoup this. Also, the session is recorded, so you can watch it over again if you want to, or share it with your friends.
Mm-hmm.
But you're the only one who can see it live. Okay, let's do this. We wanted to, you know, you always wanted to do something interesting in the beginning, right? So we're going to begin with an interesting little magic trick. Do you believe in magic? Are you guys tired? That's a yes or no question. Silence is not a valid answer.
Yeah,
Thank you.
Just the first day of TechEd. So you've
the
so
first
far been,
day.
I mean, seeing the keynote and the sessions after the keynote that describe whatever you've seen in the keynote. So let's do this.
So we have this magic, and I'm going to explain it, this magic JPEG picture. It's actually a JPEG picture that can be used to compromise web servers. How cool is that? And I have it here. So just to prove it to you guys, this is an upload function, a standard upload function in an ASPX application. It's used to upload photos for a profile. And this is taken from a live case. So this was a popular web application that we pen tested. And the purpose of a pen test is to see if there are any vulnerabilities that you can utilize in order to compromise that system. So basically what you're doing is you're trying to circumvent the filtering mechanisms in the upload so that you can upload something different than what it's supposed to be uploading, which is, in this case, a JPEG file, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you want to upload? Well, the natural thing if you're attacking a web server would be, any developers here? That would be an ASPX file that would execute on the server, right? So if you're an attacker, a hacker, a pen tester, you want to somehow upload an ASPX file, and you want to be able to find it later on. In this case, it's kind of convenient because you're uploading a profile photo, so it's going to be visualized on the website someplace, right? So that's pretty safe that I'm going to be able to kind of find it. So it's fairly interesting. I'm going to show it to you. So if I browse my pictures, And I try to upload, for example, this anonymous JPEG. I can upload it, and I can see it. And this is not dangerous, even though the face might scare you. and if you would, for example, rename this guy and call him ASBX instead, do you think that's dangerous? If I would upload him now, go see him. Not really, no, right? There is a problem with this filter application that you can see. It somehow uploading files with an AXPX extension, but this is still just a picture, right? So if I were to take any other picture or something that is not a picture, would it accept it? That's a good question, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's see if I can upload a real AXPX file that does bad things. And we're getting to the magic. It's going to be here very soon. So I'm going to go to my folder here and do, for example, I think I have a shell someplace in my things. So this is a Chuzik mini shell. This is just something that will give me a command prompt access. So if I take this and try to, I'm going to copy it and put it in the picture folder just to make sure that I'm in the right place. I'm actually going to rename this magic. I'm going to show you why. Magic JPEG. Just a picture. So, if I upload this Evil Knievel file, browse. Sometimes when you mess with things, they get kind of disturbed. Then you shut them down, you restart them, and you are always a little bit annoyed when you do it. No, it finally appears. So, Minishell, upload this guy. Do-do-do-do-do. Upload.
I think IE is a little bit upset.
I think I was messing with the server, and this is also an interesting scenario. This happens a lot. So when you do this stuff, you usually need to know what you're doing, which I don't. So I'm going to restart the server, actually.
Yeah.
But as you can see on the other side here, I uploaded these files. They're here, so this is the folder. You can see the back end. But I'm going to restart the server.
So it's a quite interesting scenario if you're just uploading a JPEG file and rename it to ASPX. The server starts reading it. It thinks it's an ASPX file, but the binary content is, well, you understand why it's a little bit upset about that.
Yeah, we'll get there. No worries. So, while it's starting, let's go for the magic. And can you please die? Just to make me happy. I can't curse in this country. I hate that. In Sweden, it's okay to say the F word and all that stuff, but here I get it in the evals. So I'm going to have to find this.
You can still say it
now
in Swedish.
Now it died. Thank you.
You can still say it in Swedish.
I can say it in Swedish?
Yes.
I can curse in Swedish?
Uh-huh.
Is that true?
They won't understand that word.
Anyhow, if I were to upload a mini shell, upload this file, it would say upload a file is not an image.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where I want to go. This is not an image. So I can assume that this application is, and this happens a lot when you do pen testing. You break applications, you have to wait for a while until the sysadmin realizes that, oh, his computer feels bad, so it has to restart it for me. So somehow it accepts the extension ASPX, but it does not accept an ASPX file. It wants a real JPEG file. So what they're probably doing, if you're a coder, they probably have this input validation that will actually read the stream from the file to validate that this is a real JPEG file, right? So now comes the magic trick. This is also just a JPEG file. And I can prove it to you guys. This is a JPEG file, right? Correct? This is where you nod or you shake your head or something. Feedback. Thank you. That's what you tell your kids. Can you please answer me? God damn it! So now I'm going to rename this JPEG file into an ASPX file. This is the only thing I'm doing. I'm giving it a new name. Okay? Now I'm going to browse for this file, and I'm going to upload it. I'm going to look at it. And there's a shell here. This is the magic. If you're a real geek, this is when you say, wow. But you don't know what it does yet. So let's do something. Let's do ipconfig. So this is a JPEG file that will give me the IP address of the system it's running on. This is where you normally clap your hands.
Good.
They're waking up. Mm-hmm. We can always blame the heat. So, well, what do you want to do now? I mean, I can execute code on this system, host name. Sure, I'm DMZ100. Who am I? Ah, damn, that app pool account. I want it to become system. That sucks, okay? But I can execute code on this machine. That's really interesting. What do you think I want to do now? So, I want to do something nasty. So, the thing is, people don't realize that when they have a problem, it can lead to bigger problems. Usually when you find something like this, you kind of maybe patch it, but you never really look into if something really happened, especially not on other systems than this particular one. So I'm going to continue this attack and compromise some internal resources using this small foothold that I have because of this JPEG image. And in the end of the session, I'm going to explain how you can make your own. It's not that difficult, if you know what you're doing. So, what I want is a real good, nice Trojan. So I'm going to create a Trojan. And I'm going to use Metasploit. If you've never seen it before, this is a free-to-use attack framework. And I can actually create my own evil .exe files, which will be like Trojan files, by just a click of some buttons. So in this case, I'm going to run the MSF payload, which can generate a payload for me. And the payload is going to be a meterpreter. The meterpreter is the Metasploit Trojan. So I'm going to tell it to, whenever you're installed someplace, can you please connect back to the attacker machine over a port of my choice? And this could be SSL or whatever. I'm just going to do a nice, simple demo now. So I'm going to create this. This will mean that it's going to become a binary. And I'm going to put it in my web server folder on the attacker. So I'm going to publish this file to the internet. That's nice, isn't it? So this is going to take a little bit of time. While I'm creating this payload, I'm going to set up a listener on the attacker. So he's going to listen to Trojans trying to phone home. Okay? So I'm going to use something called the multi-handler in Metasploit. This is listening for attack computers wherever they come from. So this is a multi-listener listening for whoever's trying to connect to give me his meterpreter. So I'm going to use this. In the Metasploit, you just use first, and then you set a lot of parameters. You can check them by doing set, so you know what it asks for. I'm going to tell it to do a payload. So whenever this 4444 file comes home, it's going to be a reverse TCP connection to me. And then I'm going to configure. So you should connect to this local host. Set a port of my choice. And again, port 444, that's pretty lame. If you ever find that, you're lucky. Normally they use SSL, and you have SSL tunneling and all that stuff. So after I set all this, I can just do exploit or run. So this is now waiting for connections. At the same time, I'm going to look on the other side and say, well, it created this payload. So if I go to my Moongoose folder, I can see there is a 444 EXE here. And if I haven't already, yeah, I have the Moon Goose running. So if I want to surf to myself, I am the attacker. I can browse to this folder. And I can see that I'm hosting this 444.exe to the internet, okay? So next challenge would be to make the web application here to make him download my 444.exe, right? That's what I want to do. And I can do this really fast, but I'm going to do it step by step. So this is an example. How many of you guys are developers? Just so I know. That's a big bunch. Great. So then you're familiar with shellcode, of course. If you shake your head now, then it's going to be a big problem. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to echo some text into the operating system through this small web shell. So I'm just going to echo C# code. And what I want to do is I want to run the web client download file function with two arguments, that is, download something from someplace and put it someplace, okay? But again, this is just source code, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to echo this out to the temp folder of that web server, and I'm going to name it dl.cs. So the only thing I'm going to do is I'm going to put this text here, which is just a DOS command, paste, run it. It was fairly fast. I mean, again, I could do dir percent temp percent. So this is kind of convenient. I have feedback here. So, I mean, this is not the best way of doing it, maybe, but you can see here dl.cs is uploaded to the system. So I get feedback. So is there a built-in compiler in Windows? Or do you need to have Visual Studio? Yes? No? Yes? Yeah, there is. CSC.exe is in .NET Framework, C# compiler, for example. So I have source code on that system. I'm obviously allowed to execute code in this context of this account, which is the most hardened account that people normally use when they run a web server. So I'm just going to tell the dl.exe, sorry, I'm just going to build it. So I'm just going to go to the csc.exe file, and I'm going to give it two parameters, compile this file into this file. So I'm just going to paste it in. This is how simple it is. As you can see, it took some time. This gives me some good feedback. You can also see that the compiler was working. And if they don't have .NET Framework 3.5, I can just browse around the file system and see what they have. So it's fairly simple. So now I have this downloader in here. What I want to do now is I want to tell the downloader to download, right? So I'm going to tell dl.exe to go to the evil web server and get file 444.exe and put it in the temp folder. It takes some time, nice feedback. Again, I can do dir percent temp percent. And this is fairly easy to find. 73k point something. Nice, evil code, compiled and all. So anyhow, next step would be simple. It would be to check the listener and see that it's up and running. So this is waiting. I want to visualize this so you can see it simultaneously when I do this. Because all I need to do now is actually to do temp / 4444.exe, right? Things are happening on the attacker. There's some interpreter session opened. So if we look at the simplest diagram ever, you will now know that Where is this? There it is. So I'm on the attacker, but I'm executing code on the web server. And the interpreter is actually executing down here. My goal is to go from the web server to an internal server and then compromise to the main controller. I think that would make a good point that you should secure a web application. What do you think? Kind of, right? So, back to the attacker. With this meterpreter agent, there are a lot of functions that I can use in order to do evil things. So this is a very competent Trojan. I can read keystrokes, I can get screenshots, I can do almost whatever I wanted, depending on my privileges. The problem here is I don't have so much privileges. I'm just a simple, normal dude. So I'm going to get myself a shell, which is a regular command prompt. And then I'm going to browse around the file system a little bit, because this is what you normally do when you're an attacker. You want to find something that you can use in order to attack some internal systems. So just by accident, I happen to know where to look. Isn't that strange? And it's not in the XXX pick pull-up folder. No, it's not, so don't worry. It's not in the My Secret Stash folder either, actually. So normally you look for config files, different kind of source code files, script files, whatever you can find that could include credentials in them. So I'm going to type the login.aspx.old
underscore.
This is why I bring a sign. He knows how to recognize an underscore.
ASPX.
Sorry?
ASPX.
ASPX. Yeah, I'm old school. Sorry. Old.cs. Then we can probably do some fine string and look to see if there is an SA account or something in there. Maybe I should actually write fine string too. I'm getting old. So, find strsa, for example. So this is, wow, I found something. This computer 10.10.10.110, this is actually not a valid connection string, so this dude is really not something I would brag about. But he has this IP address here. He has an SA account and a password. So I'm going to use Metasploit to see if I can connect from this meterpreter into that database server using a meterpreter or Metasploit SQL attack. The cool thing about this attack is that it will only need port 1433. It will utilize the functionality of the SQL server in order to put a meterpreter on that system and execute it. Of course, if you have the right credentials. So I'm hoping for this SA account to be powerful. So I'm going to have to leave the shell. I'm going to have to remember all this stuff. So exit back to the real meterpreter. And I'm going to hide it in the background. I love this. This is not even coding. You can tell it what to do. Go to the background. It just happens. So then after that, I'm going to find this... this SQL payload. So the only thing you do here is you say you want to use the payload that takes some input. You need to say who to attack. You need to have the password. Of course, you need a username, but it will default to SA. So I am on the attacker. Sorry, I am on the web server, but I'm going to be able to connect to the inner workings of this enterprise. Normally, I mean, this is my demo environment, so these guys are sitting next to each other, but normally there would be a router hop, right? The cool thing about Metasploit is that they have functionality, something called pivoting. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, but I'm Swedish, so I don't mind much. But you can do something called order route. So if you find the IP of an internal server, you can just set that route, then everything will be routed through this interpreter. Okay? So I can access internal systems. That's what I'm trying to tell you. You look a little bit confused here, but I think you got it. Eventually, you will see the effect anyway. That's more important. So I'm going to use this payload. And then I'm going to set all the parameters. Let's set the what's going to happen whenever it hits. It's going to do a reverse TCP, actually back to that multi-handler. And one of the reasons I'm using Metasploit as a demo right now is because it's free to use. So you know from now on, unless you didn't know already, that this could be anyone downloading it from the internet and using it just to attack you guys. All you need is some kind of web application with a vulnerability, some kind of clue that will take you to some inner systems. So I'm going to tell the interpreter to call back to the same IP address as before, but I'm going to target this code to attack the internal server 110. And it's going to default to 1433. So here I just enter the password that I found in the password file. Do you recognize this password? It's in the SQL Server manual. I think we found it like 100 times on pen tests, because people read the manual. This is how to install SQL. Enter a strong SA password in the password field.
Literally.
The very definition of stupidity. I'm not even joking. So I configured this attack towards the SQL Server. I'm pressing exploit. So what it does now, it's encoding a binary, and it's piping it through the SQL channel that only accepts text input, basically. And then it's also piping a VB script in there that will do the decoding. So on the other side, it will become a binary again. And this is now done, and there is a session 2 opened. So I now own 110, because some sloppy admin left a password there. So session 2 is open. What do I want to do now? Well, I want to see who I am, get UID. I'm obviously a system, so the SA account was running on the system, but you can do simple trips. Like if I do an IP config, or whatever. I'm actually going to go to shell. This is not a real IP config. This is meterpreter IP config. This is a real one. And do IP config /all, for example. There are other ways you can find out who you are. But just as an example, the DNS suffix is etherip.internal. So my assumption is this is a domain member of the domain etherip.internal. So maybe this is an internal SQL server, right? If it's a private IP address, that would also be a good assumption, right? So this is kind of bad. I mean, I compromised an internal SQL server, but could it be worse? Damn, they're smart. So, if I wanted to, the internal, maybe I could do net use and try to compromise the domain control like this, etherip.internal/$. That doesn't work. Why not? The system account is not a domain admin. This is a local account on the system, right? But a local account is still a powerful account, so let's do this. Exit. Let's look at what sessions are running or processes are running on this system with the PS command. And I can see that there are a lot of processes running. Some is started by the system account network service. Some stuff is also started by the domain administrator etherip for the etherip domain. The read 500 account for the domain. So for me, it would be natural to try to somehow inject myself into this process by stealing the token. Process 2348. Do you know how difficult that is? Do you know how damn difficult that is with Metasploit? That is so difficult. Look at this. Steal token.
That's difficult.
So what was it? Remembering the number, that's more difficult. 2348. That's how simple it is. So now, welcome. You're now Etherip administrator. So now you can do a shell again if you want to. You can do who am I. Sorry, I was too fast. Who am I? Was that that fast? Yeah, I think I messed it up. No worries. Steal token. 2348. Shell.
Just connect to the DC, I think.
No, I think who am I?
It's spanning another.
Spanning a shell, that's strange. Let's do net use. Etherip.internal. Dot C dollar. I'm not giving up, don't worry. I almost never give up, which is stupid sometimes. Net. It's kind of annoying to be the domain admin and not be able to mount a share. Command completed successfully. So as long as you don't do who am I. So, I mean, if you're any technical savvy at all, I can mount the hard drive or the domain controller. I can do anything. What we usually do in penetration tests, just to make you understand how, the impact of this, is we go for a GPO. We find a GPO that is affecting the entire domain. For example, the domain GPO. And then we just inject a script into the sysfold folder. And we edit two files by doing just echo. So we tell the GPO that there is another script that you should also execute at startup. And then we increase a version number of the GPO so the computers knows that there's an update, so they have to GP update, enforce, or just execute that new policy. So when they start up, they get an interpreter. So you can compromise the entire domain. So I hope you appreciate the live demos, but the purpose, again, it's simple. I want you to understand the impact of one flaw someplace and some dependencies. So we're going to move from here and talk about web, and talk about web flaws and do the OWASP list and give you some examples. But... Thank you. That's because you're so nice. I'm going to reward you, not collectively, just the guys in the front. Because they pick the seats in the front. These are chocolate bars. And you know what? It's Swedish chocolate, it's the best. You know what? I have this dude up here. He's been coming to my sessions for like, I don't know what, 9 years, or he said nine different tech ads. So I'm going to personally let him pick a flavor. And I do have a t-shirt your size down in the booth as well. So pick a flavor, honey. That's dark chocolate in Swedish, mörkoklad. Is that what you want? Are you sure? You can switch it anytime. Just don't do anything with it before you switch it. Okay, cool. You want one? Then go to the front. Well, that's fair. Yeah, maybe later. Who knows? I mean, I want to throw them out, but I can get sued in this country. I can't afford that. So if I want to throw something else, it's going to be a t-shirt. To the guys in the front. Maybe you get the message. I don't know.
So thank you, Marcus. That was a very nice demo. Why you shouldn't have flaws in your web applications. So where did this fall in into the, I mean, we promised speaking about the OWASP, the Open Web Application Security Project. This is the Web Application Security Project top 10 list, things not to do when you're a developer or when you're considering web applications. So where did the things Marcus did fall in into this list? Actually, we do have the number 9, which is, in this case, going to be using components with vulnerabilities or known vulnerabilities. This is a file upload component, or the file upload script, or that part of application that actually had this vulnerability that allowed Marcus to upload something executable on the server, which is, in this case, was very interesting. It's almost magic. It's not really magic if you understand the code behind. I don't know if you want to show that.
Yeah, we can do it. Why not? Do you want to see why that JPEG really worked?
Yeah.
Thank you. I was about to sell it, but why not give it away?
Yeah. And of course, within the OWASP 10 list, we still have some security consideration here as well. So Marcus could go the whole way to the domain controller and actually get hold of domain credentials, which were domain admin. So we do have security boundary crossing in this operation as well. So that's another part of the OWASP list.
Yeah, I'm going to put a tool in. I'm going to take one of my tools from my demo folder, the EXIF tool, and I'm going to put it in the pictures folder just so you can see that these are the real, and I'm going to rename them back so you can see that these are JPEG pictures. And this was actually found by a colleague of mine. His name is Linus. I'd like to give them a little bit of credit, the guys who find the stuff, one of the guys on my team. And again, it was pen testing, and he couldn't get through, so he was playing with his file formats. So if you take this tool, if you take this, didn't I put it there?
No, was it the attacker?
Sometimes I talk too much. Huh?
This PC picture, was, let's see.
I thought I put it there, but I didn't. I was talking about it. No worries. I have all the time in the world. Control C, pictures. Control V, magic.
Yeah.
Damn, hardcore hacking right there. Dear, yay. So EXIF tool,
JPEGs.
You can just check the JPEGs. This is the anonymous, which is not so dangerous. And you can get a lot of metadata from this. Mm-hmm. So this will tell you about the file and, you know, stuff like when it was made, how big it is, but also some other things. It was made by Adobe Photoshop and stuff. It's kind of interesting read, actually. Sometimes you can see which camera took the photo and stuff.
Yeah.
So doing this on the other tool would give you a different result, or you would see something more. This is a TrueSec JPEG. Can you see anything strange here? This is the code. So what Linus realized was that this is just a picture. So the comment data will be placed in the beginning of the file in the header. Actually, sometimes it will be right in the very first place in the header. So when you rename this to ASPX and you throw it to a web server, it will look at the header and say, well, this is ASPX code. I recognize this. So it would start executing. Silence is good.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, some pictures doesn't work. I don't know why, really. We haven't really looked into it, because if we have a few pictures that works, but I think about 50%. It's strange. Some of the darker pictures always work. Some of the brighter aren't. So I think it's about being evil or something. I don't know.
But yeah, or probably the Unicode character represented by that color thingy will mess up your file. So IIS will not be able to read it as interpret it as a text file, which ASPX files are supposed to be. So.
But the big learning from this is hackers would always try to circumvent the security systems. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if anybody else did this ever before. This is the first time we ever presented, so maybe this is the first time anybody outside Trusik knows about it. Yeah, the paying customer as well that had to change web application.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a common application made by many others, or used by many others. So wasn't homegrown.
This is simply not a zero day. This is not a vulnerability in IIS or in the .NET platform. This is a just by default behavior.
Yeah.
Cool. So let's dig through some of the other points in our list. And the major things in the top 10 list are actually all about input validation. We have a whole bunch about injections and cross-site scripting and all kind of sensitive data exposure and so on. So I will just guide you guys through some of that. So let's go ahead to another application I have here. Let's see. This is another application we just prepared for this session. So apparently there is a news page and you can search and put words or whatever, and probably you could put some tokens in here as well. I mean, just putting different wording or tokens and it will be presenting you with the news articles. Okay, so the first thing we do, if we can, suspect that there is a SQL server behind this, there is some kind of a SQL statement generated, we will try with a single quote. That's a very classic thing. So just try with a single quote and hope that the application is responding positively. I mean, this is what I call is a positive response. I would like very much to see an error message. Now, this is a very non-blind response. The application is telling me exactly, hey, there is an error. The data type var character is not matching or incompatible with the operator, whatever that is. So this is a very informative error message. This is a problem per se. So your application shouldn't respond this way. They should tell, hey, there was an error, or no content was found, or no articles were found, and so on. So let me just try to see, okay, does this really work? If I just add the classic comments, just comment the rest of the statement, if this is going to be a part of the statement, just the double dash, just comment the rest of the statement and do the filter. Well, all of a sudden everything works just perfectly. So apparently I can inject some special characters and change the behavior of the statement.
Oh, jeez.
Well, that's good.
So I got robbed.
So let's see, how are we proceeding from here? And how much information could we get from this application? Could it reveal anything else? Can we get hold of interesting pieces of data within the tables, within the database? Is it possible to get hold of usernames? Is it possible to get hold of table names and so on? So let's dig through this together. So let me just, I have some prepared input strings over here. So here's the first one. Finishing the input, what I think, the input here, and start to continuing the statement by the word order by, and telling it, hey, order by position 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, in my imagination, there may be 10 different columns returned, 10 different pieces of information returned in that request. So let's see if that's true. And just go ahead. And it simply responds back to me and says, hey, order position number 4 is out of range. And it continues for the rest of them. So this simply tells me that there are only 4 pieces of data columns returned to me by the row set or the result set. So that's perfect. Let's see what type of information I can get about these values that are returned by the application. So I will go ahead just to verify that it is 3 of them. So I'll just go ahead and try to give it, hey, union whatever you're getting back from the database, union select that with the values null, null, null. I just provided a select. Give me a union with the previous results. Add this specific result to it. Just go ahead and filter. And it says, hey, you got some trouble with the casting. You got some trouble with the typing. The two results are not matching. The thing you're getting back is not matching the nulls you're adding to it. So it's giving me very good hints. Now, as I said, this is very informative error messages we got in this application. This is, I mean, the ideal situation for a hacker or an attacker in this case. So let's go further. Let's check. Okay, is it text or is it numerical? Let's try with the text. So I'm just giving it empty strings here. Single quote with nothing in between. And just go ahead. And now there are no error messages anymore. So apparently the return values are all of them. All the three values are text values. So I can try to put some other things here and just observe and see the behavior of that. Let's go on. So what happens if I try to get more information? Let's see, this one shouldn't work. The version variable is actually should return number or text? No, it should actually. It works because this one is returning a text string. This is the version of the SQL Server running behind the scenes. So I figured out that, hey, I could grab any text value and push it, union select that, into the previous selection I already did. Okay, and the first one is an empty string, and then, hey, give me the version string. This is an internal version string from my SQL Server.
Yeah, and so this is what they call SQL enumeration. You're just enumerating the SQL Server, and you want to understand the logics behind it. So again, there are two major kinds of SQL injection. We have the blind ones that don't give you any feedback, and we have the non-blind. This is a non-blind. And this is natural if it's like a product database or something, so you're supposed to filter for products, and it's supposed to give you output. If this was blind, you wouldn't see the version. But then maybe you can do other things. We're going to lead to that later. But again, this is not unusual, but this is valid to certain applications that are supposed to give you feedback.
So let's extend this a little bit more. I'm just continuing with my union select. I'm just going ahead with the two empty strings in the beginning. And now I'm adding a cost to a var character. This is give me the text representation of the thing here. And the thing here is I'm calling a function. And the function is the server role member, does that exist or no? And the server role member I'm looking for is the sysadmin. So this function will just basically just check the current user and looks what roles that current user actually is covering or is belonging to in the SQL Server. So I'm just telling, hey, check that please. And the return value is 1, which means simply true. Yes, that current user we're running, the user is running the SQL statement, does have that role. He or she or that account is a system admin, or whoever configured that, that's a system admin account, is running on the SQL Server. Okay, that's cool. So we can do a whole lot of interesting things. That we are not only limited to our database, so we can go outside of our database and start digging into the system databases and the system tables. So let's enumerate some of the system databases and tables in here. So I'm telling it, hey, okay, continue with the union select and select from the sys databases. Give me the name of all the databases. There we go. So these are the names of the databases on that SQL Server. And just continue. I mean, your imagination is the limit. Okay, give me all the system objects were defined by the user or manually. There are objects like named documents, news, table, user profile, user bad, user good, and so on. Because these are probably tables defined in the system, defined manually. These are none of the built-in system tables. That's the type XIPU indicating. So let's dig further. The user bad or the user's bad. I'm just focusing on that right now. So I'm telling it, hey, give me that information from the sysobjects where the name of the object is usersBad.
UsersBad? What the hell is that?
Okay, that's apparently a table, and that table contains some fields, the age, the description, the ID, and the password, and the role, and the username. You see, I'm digging my way through into the different pieces of information, the different data sets. I can basically go through, if this was hundreds of tables, I can just do the same thing for every table until I find something of interest and then go ahead with that. So there is another table called users really bad. It's the same type of information in it. Apparently there is an age, description, ID, password, and username. So let's start looking at that information in these tables. Okay, so I know the column names, I know the table name, so I'm just doing, continuing with the union select. Give me the username, the password from that user bad table. I just have that information, so why not? Just go ahead there, push it, and there we have the usernames and the passwords for those users.
So many times when you find these large dumps on the internet and there's a lot of talking about a company getting compromised and their entire database was dumped and exposed on the internet, sometimes they just compromise the SQL Server like this. That's fairly common.
It could be just these simple steps somebody's carried out and then they're ending up with a huge list of usernames and passwords. Now, this seems to be an encrypted password. I don't think these are clear text passwords. The format, the length, they are keeping the same structure, kind of.
You don't think so?
I doubt that we have that many users with
really
that type of passwords. I don't know.
You are a smart
somebody
dude.
Else maybe have some other experiences in this. Let's do a search. I just took one of these, what I think is an MD5 or a SHA-1, and just Google it up, okay? So I'm getting some hits. I'm just providing that. I'm already getting some hits on that. So this is an interesting, it says file hash info, hash PHP, text, summer, 2012.
It's funny, many times we find
so the summer, the text string of summer 2012 does have the MD5, the one I just did search for.
So many times we don't even have to crack the password, we can just paste them on Google. Which is not so good, because then Google knows about it too, but.
Yeah. So let's check. Okay, apparently Alice and Bob shares the same password. Well, it's the same hash value. So easy, I can sort this list and figure out which passwords are unique and which not. So what about test? What do you think? Let's just Google that. Yeah, reverse MD5, reverse for the, okay. Reverse. Did we get anything? Yeah. Okay, so
it's kind of funny when you think about it, but you heard about the Adobe hack, right? That Adobe got hacked and they exposed 42 million passwords.
Mm-hmm.
We did some analysis on the password database, which was, I mean, a lot of companies did. It was kind of fun. We did it with a smaller focus. I'm Swedish, so we checked the Swedish part of the database, and I actually know all the passwords. I know the password of the prime minister in Sweden's password, which equals the president. So he's got banana shell. His biggest opponent.
Yeah, in Swedish, of course.
He's using his nickname Steffe as his password. His name is Stefan. So these are the brightest minds in our country. They're leading the country. But it was interesting, though, in the Adobe case, because they had encrypted passwords. But the thing is, when you dump the database the way I signed it right now, you could get the username, you could get the password, but you could also get the password hint, So both Frederick, who is the prime minister, and Steffe, who is his opponent, neither of them had a password hint. But by simply looking through the list and the filter and sorting the list, we could see that other people with the same hash, they had a hint. And a lot of people were referring to bananas, and that you slip and stuff like that. So that was a banana shell. Everybody had the banana shell. And then, whatever you call it in English, I don't know. Is it banana shell? Peel, yeah, you peel off the banana. Yeah, that's why you're not laughing. I know, I'm funny. And same thing with this Stefan guy. I mean, there were like 100 Stefan, and they all had the same hash. So it was, and some of them had nickname as the hint. It was some other people had some common, some people in the government, they had my work password as a hint. Mm. And then you could see other people having hints that would give you the name of that, so you could probably remote into the government using their username and password. So it's kind of interesting what you can learn from doing this. So, I mean, the take-home from this is going to continue is obviously that it's really important to filter for SQL injections. Mm. It's not just about all the credentials that you don't want to give the underlying operating system and stuff like that. It's about securing the database per se.
So just to give you another example, which we can see in some applications as well, now that's why the really users really bad table exists. It's just a way some developers choose to do to store the passwords in clear text. So we know now we don't need to crack anything. The admin has admin Solmart, Alice, summer 2012, Bob, they shared the same password and so on.
Yeah.
So we just chosen to have these different tables representing what we are actually seeing out there when we're performing these type of tests, these penetration testings, and verifying the applications out there. Yeah.
Sometimes they encrypt them and they store the decryption key in the database. That's pretty smart too.
Yeah. By using hash values in MD5 or SHA1 or whatever other hash functions is very popular. And the bad thing here is that if you have the same password, you will end up with the same hash unless you're having a specific salt value for each user password, which is possible, then you will add some more difficulty, some more security into that as well. So this is actually combined. The thing I showed is not just one thing. It's partially injection problem. We're not verifying the input we're getting from the user back to our application the correct way. We're allowing way too much things to happen in the background. We're trusting the input from the user, kind of 100%. So we should be whitelisting, blacklisting, filtering out, or escaping the information it's getting back to us from the user, back to the application. And all of these methods does exist in our platform. Despite that, we're still seeing this type of vulnerabilities, even though the applications are very modern. I'm just using the latest version of Visual Studio, and that doesn't grant any of that per se. So I must be, as a developer, aware about this fact. So we're covering injections, we're covering broken authentication and session management. Basically, we can get hold of that information because of the injection problem. And then there is sensitive data exposure in different ways. So I didn't need to perform any logon. I just could go to the search field and enumerate the data from that database and get hold of user logins and passwords. We actually did have another vulnerability in this application, which is a classic one in the logon field. This is, a simple. Okay, it requires both of them. Let's see there. And we should end up with, You see, I have Visual Studio in the background. So it says, there was an error. It's actually catching on an exception in this particular case. And I'm getting there is an incorrect syntax near test. So this is how we should behave. The application should catch on that error and perform some other actions instead of just giving it back to the user and say, hey, would you like to continue? We don't bother about if we encounter an error or not. So the application should stop processing at that point, and we should have a decent error handling in such a case. Okay, let's close that part and go ahead. Another thing we would like to show you, another piece on the top 10 list, is all about the cross-site scripting. This is a very interesting topic. If we look at the About page, the About link over here, it says error, something went wrong. If you observe the URL, we are ending up in an error page that says error, question mark. Now, we got some parameters to that request. It says error message equals something went wrong. So test, well, error test. Okay, so this is something I can probably use to pass information. I can use that URL, change that piece of information, pass it over to a user who happens to trust this site, and all of a sudden things are showing up in that web page. Okay, the user might be not aware about, this was just basically part of the URL. Let's see. Let's just play with this a little bit. I have a text-to-hex converter. Let's just use that. The word test, just convert that into its hexadecimal representation. This, that's the word test still, although it's not reading test. But the computer will, as you can see, I just typed it in there. Well, it is actually replaced by test, by the browser, and it's still test here. So if I push this URL to a user, the user will never know that, hey, there is a word test in the URL, unless you are a developer and you can play with hex back to the text representation on the fly. So let's do this. Script, alert, tell it to say something. Say hey in Swedish.
Say hey in Swedish, you say hi in Swedish.
No, that's hey. And okay, so the error message is not anymore there. I'm not getting any other type of error, so what's the deal? Why isn't it happening? Should it happen? Let's test this in another browser.
Ow. So I hate to say it, but fact is fact.
So. Let's see. There are developer tools. I go straight ahead to the console and says, hey, I noticed this. There is an XSS auditor built in the browser, obviously. Refused to execute a script on the page. Simply because it's observed that that script was part of the requested URL. Well, that's very good. And the web page didn't tell the browser that it's safe to execute scripts being represented from the URL in the page itself. So that's the behavior of Chrome. Now, IE is behaving simply a little bit different. It's showing or executing that script and showing that alert message to the user.
Yeah, let's just say it's a more open-minded browser.
So at this point we can simply just send any JavaScript scripts to our users, just give them a customized URL, and whenever they click on that URL, that JavaScript that is part of embedded in the URL will execute on their browser. So we can redirect them to another page. We can, depending on how rich you can execute on the web browser, or if there are any local vulnerabilities or something like that, you can possibly go further on and exploiting that user experience as well.
Yeah, some of the interesting attacks we have found in cross-site scripting is, for example, one big web email service where there was vulnerable to cross-site scripting, where they could actually, if somebody clicked the link, you would send all your emails to somebody, for example. So cross-site scripting can be really bad. Another typical example is that you give it to admins, So when they click a link, you log, they log you in as them, as the attacker. So cross-site scripting, again, when it comes to web, click a link. Sometimes you can do functions and stuff in the URL.
Mm-hmm. So let's just check this. There is another function here. Whenever I'm logged in, apparently I can add news to the news list. So there is a form for that. We are able to add news form. There is a section for that. And then there are a couple of input fields. And whenever I hit the save button, things will get executed, pushed back to the application. It will appear in the database and it will appear on the list at the far end. So can we do any magic with this? Can we make that admin or that user who's able to add news to the list doing that on our behalf, so to say? Can we in any way just generate a page? Whenever they visit that page, they will end up in adding in a news article. So let's just check a couple of files I do have here. Let's see there. This is a very simple posts file, just an HTML file. The only reason I created that, you see the action is going to the add news URL, and it's simply submitting a form. There is a title, there is text, and there is submission buttons. I've just read that information through the web page and or just let the communication go through a proxy or something like that, and then trying to replicate that or generate that programmatically. So if I let that admin visit this page, and we'll observe the results. So let's go ahead. I keep that page as is. Go to cross-site request forgeries and post 1.html. Actually, I don't have the post 3.html. So as you could see here, it's actually executed the form automatically. The HTML page was designed that way. And we are redirected back to this, and I do actually have two other news articles in here. These weren't here before. If you look here, they are not here. This is before, this is after. So if I go refresh this page, there we go. They are there. So this is a very simple yet very powerful demo of cross-site request forgery. We understand how the forms are built. We can send arbitrary information as part of another page to that destination. If you have a proper logon on this page, then we can execute our scripts.
Yeah.
Now, the major problem here is not that we can send the information. The major problem is actually the application doesn't have any follow-ups on the postings. So there should be a state control. They should be okay. You actually loaded that that piece of information. We know who you are as a user. We can track your user identity and that you are authoritative for doing this type of posting, and then we accept the posting as a result. Yeah. So none of that does exist in this application.
Yeah, the typical thing when we do pen testing and we find this behavior is we send emails to admins. So we create a user account, we send this to admins, and we make them put us in the admin group. So we become admins. Just an example of what you do with cross-site script request forgery.
Yeah. So these are two simple cases. The first one was the cross-site scripting, and the second one is the request forgery. Now, we can always combine the cross-site scripting with the request forgery. That's the perfect case. If there are both of them, and then we can send them a very well-designated URL that will send them along to some other pages and perform some other magic on the fly. Okay. Marcus actually did show the security misconfiguration. As I said, we do have in this application some invalidated referencing and URL redirection. We have, though, some other things we would like to show you. Actually, we did promise that through Twitter and Facebook.
What?
The OpenSSL.
The Heartbleed?
The Heartbleed vulnerability.
How much time do we have left?
Not much. 2 minutes.
Really? Is the session ending in 2 minutes?
No, go for it.
Time flies, doesn't it? Damn, I thought we had like half an hour. I thought we've been here for like 5 minutes.
Okay. So let's just switch.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the Heartbleed. There's been a lot of talk about the Heartbleed attack, right? I mean, this was a problem in OpenSSL, and a lot of applications are using OpenSSL. I don't think a big portion of the real vulnerable applications has been even assessed yet. We found in our office a lot of network devices and stuff that were vulnerable, so the admin interfaces to the network devices, things like that. So it could be interesting to see what it looks like in effect. And this is I'm just running OpenSSL on Windows. And it's called Heartbleed because this is in the RFC, there's a heartbeat function. So what we're doing is we're misusing that function in order to extract RAM memory from the process. So just to give you an example, and I'm going to... Oh, they're leaving. Ah, we should never be late again. Damn. So anyhow...
You still have 15 seconds to go.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you, Thorn. So anyhow, that was a Swedish joke. Why did I do that?
Yeah.
Strange. I must be Swedish, right?
I have Metasploit running, so I can show some of that.
Yeah, run it while we're waiting.
Yes, if you just
prepare. Where are you? You're 8?
Yeah, number 8.
Good.
So I have Metasploit running on my machine. I've prepared the attack. I'm just doing a rerun, just re-execute the attack. I do have an OpenSSL server running in the background on another machine. So this is sending the client hello. It's doing the heartbeat response checking, and it's, hey, look, that it's... vulnerable for the heartbeat response would leak, so we can read memory. And in this case, I'm actually reading a chunk of the server memory. So this is just showing the recent information stored in the server memory. And so apparently there is a information from a web browser that's been visiting that page. It's actually my Chrome web browser that was visiting that page. So we can extract server memory up to 64 kilobytes at a time. That's very neat. And sometimes parts of that server memory are very much more interesting information than this. Think of the case if that happens to be the server's private key. This is all about SSL. So what if the server's private key is in the memory at the time we're starting to read? It's refreshing or reloading or starting a new thread or something like that. So that's the thing Marcus, I think, is going to try to show us.
Yeah, I'm going to try. Let's see if I can get the screen back. I mean, the reason we're doing this demo is basically to show you that this is not just a Linux thing. This does not really have to do with the OS. I mean, they have OpenSSL in the OS, but this is running on Windows. So it's about OpenSSL. It doesn't matter what OS it is. If there's a third-party application using it, then it's going to be vulnerable. So I'm going to configure Metasploit and just run it. And another thing you need to understand before you get really scared is that the problem is about accessing RAM. So if you want to extract things, it depends on whether or not they're there right now. So what you get is a little bit of a guessing contest. You don't really know. So I'm going to scan to see if this is vulnerable to Heartbleed. And sometimes this fails. I actually have a small video in case it fails. This is not because I'm doing it wrong, it's just because it's that unstable. It says its responses will leak, so at least it found it. I'm going to do another action, set action keys.
Try to, yeah.
And then I'm going to try to extract the real private key of the server. And this is something that people have known about for a while. It's kind of interesting. This was patched in some OSs months before it was disclosed. So people have been knowing about this. They have been shutting it down. So this is the private key of the server. So this is kind of scary. You can use Metasploit and just extract that key. Now you can do man-in-the-middle attacks and stuff. So if you're a government now, for example, you have the key of that server. So if anybody wants to go to that website, if you route them through you, you can process that website, interpret everything, and then you can pass them along the way. So it makes you kind of paranoid about this attack, right? This code was checked in a while back, 2 years ago. I mean, we have one of the guys in our team. His name is Johan. He's actually contributing to Linux and Unix, and he knows everybody who does that stuff. So, I mean, I think that dude is taking a lot of heat. He maybe did it just unintentionally, but who knows? I'm just being paranoid. I'm not saying he did anything. I'm just saying, if somebody puts the flow in there, it would be very convenient to do it on OpenSSL or a web server, right? So you can extract memory and steal keys. Same thing is valid. If somebody logs on, you will get their session. Mm. It will be stored in RAM. So if they run a username or password, you will get it. So this is how it works.
And the opposite is valid. A server can extract memory information from a client if that client is vulnerable running the same OpenSSL. Yeah.
We're going to finish this up.
Yeah.
I know you're all tired. It's hot in here. I know we're funny and cool and all that stuff, but still, you need to get out of here, right? So we want to say some things. There is a TrueSec challenge. If you want to challenge yourself, you can log on to this site, challengetrusec.com, and you can actually do web hacking challenges. This, I mean, it's for free. You register and you just do it for fun. So if you want to play around, if you want to do trainings, me and Hassan, we're running some different trainings in the U.S., and we have this very proficient guy in web hacking called Fabio back in Stockholm. We set up 3 dates in the U.S. If you want to come visit us whenever we're in Tampa, in this case, if you want to go to sunny Florida sometime, well, or maybe you prefer sunny Houston, I don't know. But anyhow, we have this training, so you can check that out. Another thing, me and Hassan has been working on this company, TrueSec, for 10 years. We think we want to, and it's been a great ride doing all the tickets and stuff, so we're planning to give away our laptops, actually, to the attendees of our sessions. So there's only 2 of them, but we're going to load them out on Thursday. So if you come down by our booth, which is 1947, and you participate in this competition, you'll win our laptops. We're going to have hacker tools on them, virtual targets that you can attack, registered OS. Everything's going to be there. And they have touch screens, lots of RAM, lots of disk. So if you want them, come down to the booth and chit-chat, and you can win them.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to be happy about that. But if you don't want them, you don't have to have them. I don't know what swags you usually get.
So before we leave you guys, I just want to give you one pointer. I just want to show this site. Anybody using the Bing webmaster?
This is Microsoft stuff.
I know. I just want you guys to be as curious as I am.
I want to come back here.
So
that's the cross-site scripting. Anyhow. Anyhow. So we have 2 more sessions this week. I was thrown out of ticket 1 year. It's not going to happen again. That was you. Anyhow. So tomorrow we have this session, Hacker Tools You Should Know and Worry About. It's 3:15 p.m. It was the most popular session on Channel 9 last year, so this is an update with new tools and stuff, so if you want to attend it, we'll be really psyched about it. We want you to come because we want the energy. That's going to be a way more cool, crazy session than this was. We're not going to teach you anything, we're just going to scare you. But again, it's awareness. On Wednesday, we're going to wrap it all up and teach you how to hack-proof your clients and servers in a day. It's going to be a hardening Windows with built-in Windows features session. So if you're into that, we're going to talk about how to fix things as well. I think that's necessary. So that's it from us. If you want to chit-chat, hang out, we're in the booth 1947 all the way down in the end on the right. Thank you very much
for
attending. Fill out the evals. We appreciate if you fill out the evals. That'd be great. Thank you.